It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, an author looks at what he calls a forgotten era of domestic terrorism and what we might be able to learn from it today.
First, the Black Health Coalition of Wisconsin recently created a petition to raise awareness of how toy guns affect Black communities.
The petition is called Black Moms and Grandmothers Against Toy Guns. It hopes to convince parents to stop buying toy guns for their kids. Studies show that the rate of gun-related deaths among Black Americans is much higher than the national average. Our guest says having children play with toy guns contributes to the problem.
Patricia McManus is the president and CEO of the Black Health Coalition of Wisconsin. Patricia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, what led the Black Health Coalition to create this petition?
Well, I think, you know, we're trying to find multiple ways of doing things, you know, on a very serious issue. And so we start talking, looking culturally at, you know, the relationship between moms and their boys and grandmas and their boys, and we're like, well, what could they really do? And we thought, well, this would be something simple, because I think what happens, I'm thinking, you know, 50 years ago when we tried to stop smoking, and, you know, you look at it now, and obviously I'm hoping this occurs sooner, but it's a beginning of a start for people to think, well, yeah, I shouldn't, you know, my grandson shouldn't be doing that, or my son shouldn't be doing that plan, because it's too dangerous now. And certainly the few episodes now of young boys getting killed when they have toy guns, that just escalated. So it's one of many ways that we can begin to address this. And I think we've gotten, I mean, we're starting it. It hasn't taken off yet. But when we talk to people, I think people think, well, yeah, that's something that can be done. I think if other people look at it, I saw this on, well, that's not going to, no, it's not going to do it by itself. But it just gets you thinking about the whole adage of toy guns. You know, you gave boys guns, you gave girls dolls. I mean, so that's what folks grew up on, and we need to change that dynamic and not have them playing with toy guns.
What do you want signers of this petition to do?
Well, it says to just bring awareness. I think by signing it, people are encouraging people not to play with guns. I was just looking on it, and I saw one lady who signed, says, well, she's a, you know, I'm a Latina. She said, I'm not a mom, and I'm Latina, but, you know, this is more than a Black issue, and she's absolutely right. It's just getting people to talk and to become aware of it. That's the first move towards behavior change, is when people become aware of what they can do and what that means if your son is or your grandson is playing with guns. And that really is beyond just the African-American community, but certainly since the statistics you quoted and the ones we know so well, we're really interested in getting people to just become aware. I mean, we've been doing this for 25 years in terms of having people be aware of different health issues, and we found that many in our community, they look at it and they say, oh, well, that makes sense. And I think the majority of people will.
Now, I notice you've included mothers and grandmothers. First of all, why include grandmothers in this?
Well, because for African-Americans, and again, I always have to caveat that so people think, oh, she just means that. But I know for my community, in the African-American community, grandmothers play a very, very special, important role to their children, especially their boys. And so that's why I thought, because when we originally talked about it, we said moms. We were just going to have moms. But we're like, yeah, but grandmas are kind of special, and they're special to their boys in terms of how they see their grandmothers. And we just thought that would just be another adage in terms of having grandmothers get involved, too, because they're the ones many times that end up burying their sons, and they end up with helping to take care of the grandson. So, again, after doing some informal testing the waters out there, people thought it should be both.
And then how come not gearing it also toward fathers, grandfathers?
Well, and actually, we think that that's probably what's going to happen. But we thought many times so much stuff now is being geared towards fathers and the whole new men movement of trying to get men more involved if they didn't think they were involved. So we just thought that this would be a unique way of going at it. But it doesn't mean that fathers can't sign the petition or begin to look at, well, yeah, given this, I shouldn't be buying guns or my son's playing with guns. We think more indirectly it still will get to them, but we just wanted to use the moms and grandmas.
We're talking about a petition now from the Black Health Coalition of Wisconsin called Black Moms and Grandmothers Against Toy Guns, talking with Patricia McManus, president and CEO of the Black Health Coalition of Wisconsin. And Patricia, do you think there is a direct correlation between toy guns and real-life later violence and issues with guns.
Oh, I think absolutely. I also think that even when somebody's not thinking that way, I think I mentioned to somebody else who interviewed me about this, was this last summer at my house. I looked out the door, and there was this, he couldn't have been more than 8 or 9, and he was standing like, I have a side drive, and he was standing in my driveway, and he had his hands down to the side, but then I realized he had something in his hand, and it was a gun. Now, I realized later that it was a toy gun, but he was mimicking it just like it was a regular gun. And I could see, and by the time I went to say something to him, I think somebody else said something, and he kind of ran off. But, we, you know, as adults, they mimic what we do, and it's just dangerous. And that just really kind of triggered me as well to be like, oh, my God. Now they're walking around, somebody they saw with a gun, and like I said, down to their side, like they were just ready to use it. That was just very scary.
Guns are all over our culture right now, in TV shows and movies and video games. They're part of the fabric. Do you think it's realistic that a petition like this can have an effect?
Well, I do, and it's not going to have an effect on everybody, but I think it can affect a portion for our community. There was a big discussion going on at one of the radio stations today about more people getting guns because if they're living in areas where there's a lot of gun violence or violence. Then you've got the ones who are committing the violence, then you've got the ones who feel more necessary about taking care of themselves. And we've also had injuries where children have gotten hold of real guns and have shot themselves or shot somebody else, a sister or brother. And so it's all about just having them aware if they're going to have guns, keep them safe, keep them locked, not from their children, and that they can say, no, this is not something you play with. You give them a toy to me. You give them a toy gun, you give them a mixed message. And then they just think, boy, if I can go ahead and get a real gun, they don't necessarily see that. So yeah, I mean, again, it's not a silver bullet, but you got to start somewhere. And it's just the beginning of a dialogue and a discussion. Well, and I know in our community, even if we just have a discussion, people start, oh, yeah, people will agree with it, some people won't. But it's getting people to think about it.
Well, let's say that this is successful. Let's say that 5 years from now, you've got fewer toy guns played with by kids, by boys and girls, and parents and grandmothers not buying them. What do you think might change in society, particularly in African-American culture, if there weren't guns, toy guns?
Well, I think it will not, even if that does it and there are less guns, we still have a lot more problems within our community. But I think it will at least give people the idea that they can do something about it. Because right now, I think most of the conversations that we have, I hear moms and even dads just like, you know, what can we do about this? And so I think if they begin to see some success, and success that they're part of, that I think it can move forward. And then this whole issue, like I said, we live in a gun culture, and I know trying to get people, there's some folks who just grew up with guns, and there are people in urban areas who didn't grow up with guns, but they're starting to do that now. And so hopefully we can just stem that tide somewhat and deal with their other forms of violence that we have in our community we've got to deal with as well. But clearly guns are just a major piece of it.
Now, yesterday on the show, we talked a bit about the large number of illegal guns on Milwaukee streets. There were over 600 illegal guns taken off the streets this year in Milwaukee. Did you think about focusing on gun issues directly instead of on toy guns?
Well, I mean, again, we've been part of movements by other groups who've taken the lead on other things. So this is just us dealing with this part of it. This part is what we did. But we're very much involved in other groups within the community that are looking at other forms of violence, including guns, and wanting to get guns off the street. And our organization has been working with, now we work with three different police districts in terms of putting out information and helping, trying to get people to understand about what's happening and getting guns, whether they're buyback programs, whether they're getting people who, many times they're illegal guns, or because people maybe can't qualify to get a regular gun. To get them to understand, still, if you have a gun, it's got to be, you got to figure out, you got kids around, you have a responsibility to those kids. So, yeah, so absolutely. I mean, we see many, many things going on, and I'm born and raised in Milwaukee, and just amazed at the change over the decades in terms of guns that we never knew about. My parents had, My father had a gun in the house. I never knew about it. As kids, we never knew about it. That's part of the change in that they're more open now. Folks will walk around the house with guns. They show them to kids. They, you know, all these kinds of things. And that's the kind of thing we want to try to get at. But we certainly recognize that we've also, the illegal guns, people just getting guns now because we have this concealed carry law that, you know, we don't have time to get into that. But there's a lot of political and policy issues that make it very difficult for communities that are distressed along a lot of other issues. And so, we work with that. We work with a lot of people, a lot of different issues, not just one. We can't look at one part of it.
Patricia, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Patricia McManus, president of the Black Health Coalition of Wisconsin, talking about the group's petition opposing toy guns.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
When we think of acts of terrorism here on American soil, a few major events come to mind: the first World Trade Center attack, the Oklahoma City bombing, and 9/11. They're all relatively recent events in the course of our country's history, but are widely credited for putting domestic and international terror attacks on Americans' radars and ushering in a new era of security policy.
But according to our next guest, this isn't the first time our country has been through something like this. Only a few decades ago, the country was awash in acts of domestic terrorism, things like bombings, kidnappings, and assassinations at the hands of radical groups like the Weather Underground and the Black Liberation Army. He says this earlier age of terror is an all but forgotten era of American history, and it's one that could provide perspective on how the war on terror is being waged today.
Joining us now is Brian Burrow. He's a special correspondent at Vanity Fair, and he's the author of the book Days of Rage: America's Radical Underground, the FBI, and the Forgotten Age of Revolutionary Violence. Brian, thanks for joining us today.
Real pleasure. Thanks.
Well, you tell a lot of stories, surprising, shocking stories sometimes about this 1970s era underground movement. One of the most amazing things is how thoroughly it's been forgotten in many ways. Why do you think that is?
I wish I knew why. Conservatives will tell you it's because the liberal media doesn't want to write too much about radical extremes of violence. I think it's also possible that as a people, we tend to remember those things that we want to remember. But frankly, I think the best reason is the fact is the most obvious, that is, most of the people who did all these political actions, these crimes, these bombings, for the longest time didn't want to talk about it because they might be prosecuted. And it's really only now, 40 and 45 years later, that many of these people are willing to talk candidly about what happened back then.
Well, give us a sense, big picture, how common were acts of domestic terrorism? How large did they loom in the public mind?
Bombings were an almost commonplace, almost a daily occurrence in the United States during the 1970s. And during the early 1970s, there were more than one a day. The stat that people talk about most often is during an 18-month period in 1971 and 1972, there were 2,500 bombings on U.S. soil. But it's important to emphasize that there were a different type of bombing than those we've experienced in the last 20 years. Today, a bombing may typically mean somebody's going to die. Less than 1% of the bombings in the 1970s led to any type of serious injury or death. By and large, they're what you might call protest bombings, the type of thing where people put a bomb outside a government building late at night and then issue a statement the next morning.
So who were some of the main players? Who were the active underground movements that you focus on?
Well, Days of Rage tells the story of six principal groups as well as three or four others that were almost as important. By far the most important of these groups was the Weather Underground, which was the first and the largest and the longest lived. They began their underground bombing campaign in January 1970, and it lasted until the group dissolved in 1976. There was also the second group, which was called the Black Liberation Army, which was a violent spinoff of the Black Panthers. They assassinated policemen in a three-year campaign that lasted from 71 to 73. And then there were other groups that people might dimly remember. Perhaps the most determined bombers of the decade was a group called the FALN, which was they wanted independence for Puerto Rico, and they were best known for a bombing on Wall Street of a restaurant in January 1975 that killed four people.
So in the public's mind, I mean, we had these spectacular attacks, these spectacles of 9/11 in Oklahoma City that really captured all of our attention for a long time, the Boston Marathon bombing. Was it like that then? Did people watch this all the time? Was this on people's minds all the time, or was it just part of the scenery in some ways?
It was part of the scenery. When you have two and three bombs going off every week, and many of them not hurting people, it just becomes part of the fabric of daily life. And we need to make clear we're mostly talking about things that happen in New York, in the Bay Area, and somewhat in Chicago. If you lived in rural Wisconsin, this was not part of your daily life. You did not live in fear of this. One of my favorite quotes that I found during the whole decade was in the New York Post, which interviewed a woman who witnessed a bombing by the FALN in 1977. And her quote was, "Oh, another bombing? Who is it this time?"
What was the motivation? I looking back, we might assume, oh, Vietnam War, that's what led to the protest. That's what would have led to this. You say, no, that wasn't really the main issue for these groups.
That's one of the great myths of the period, is that this was anti-war violence. Look, the left-wing militants that led these bombing campaigns in the 1970s were, in fact, violently anti-war. But they related to the war in a purely opportunistic way. They would take recruits who were anti-war, but they were first and foremost about the rights of black Americans. Many of them traced their origins to the civil rights movement. And the Weather Underground, the BLA, groups like the Symbionese Liberation Army, they were first and foremost about defending what they believed was of police violence against blacks. And inevitably, their targets were policemen.
Talking to Brian Burrow, author of the book Days of Rage, about an era of radical violence in the United States, late 60s through the 70s, into the early 80s, actually. Brian, you talked to some of the people at the center of the story, radicals, people who made bombs and so on. Are they willing to talk about this now to somebody who's going to write a book about them?
I was surprised how many were, in fact. Several dozen speak for the first time in the book about bombings, about police shootouts, about prison breaks, if you will. Now, for every one that did talk to me, three slammed the door in my face. But there are a lot of people now, either they went to prison and have gotten out, or the statute of limitations on these crimes have passed. They're in their 60s, they're in their 70s. And many of them, I think, are confronting the legacy of what their 25-year-old selves did, and trying to come to grips with it, to terms with it. And when I came along, and I think it, expressed a desire to write a down-the-middle narrative history, not a left-wing history, not a right-wing history, but just a history of what happened, a lot of people saw the value in trying to reclaim memories that I think have mostly been forgotten to most Americans.
So how did they talk about it? I mean, were you hearing regret? Were you hearing pride in what they did? What kind of emotions came out looking back?
I heard a full range of emotions. I heard regret. I heard people who were proud of what they achieved. By and large, what I wanted to get was just the story of what happened, but to the extent that they did look back, I think that the dominant message that I got was it's important for people to understand why these things were done. It's difficult for us after 9/11 to think that anybody that puts off a bomb isn't a terrorist, and many of these people wanted today's Americans to understand the conditions, the corruption of the Nixon administration, the crimes against African Americans, and yes, the Vietnam War, that were legitimate grievances. And the controversial part is that they resorted to violence as a protest.
And there was a frustration with nonviolence, with slow progress, if any, with assassinations like that of Martin Luther King. Is that that frustration part of what spurred them to violence?
Absolutely. By and large, the militants who turned violent in America in 1970 were those who were unable to give up the great dream of 1968, the dream that governments were falling, that it, literally a new world order was coming to pass. And when that didn't happen in 1969, when it didn't happen in 1970, there were a hardcore of radical militants that believed that if this revolution was actually to come, a second American revolution, that they would need to resort to war, in essence, to bring it on. They actually launched a kind of war against America, and it was a war that they ended up losing.
A turning point, you write, happened here in Wisconsin, the bombing of a building, Sterling Hall, on the UW-Madison campus, University of Wisconsin campus, I think, at the time. How did that fit into all of this?
Well, I was hoping you would bring that up, because that is the one of the most important events, and it did happen there in Wisconsin. It was a bombing of the Math Center there in August 1970, by not an underground group, but a group of local militants, if you will, that drove a stolen Econoline van, a rented Econoline van, up to the Math Center, and it was just a massive explosion, and it killed one man, a father of three. And the impact of that, the social impact, was up until that point, I think most people in the anti-war movement on the left kind of were taken up with the romance of the underground, especially the Weather Underground, that they were, you know, fighting the man, that they were giving it back to him. But it was one thing when they were doing it and not killing anybody. But when an innocent person died, you see the tone, the tenor of news coverage and of interviews with ordinary Americans really start to turn against those who would engage in underground violence. It became a much less popular pursuit after the attack there in Madison.
Briefly, Brian, should we be looking at these lessons from this era today in our counterterror efforts now?
I think the main thing that you need to realize today is the conditions that we've seen between blacks and urban police departments in the 9 months since Ferguson sharply parallel back what happened by then, but you're not going to see the type of violence we saw back then, in large part because today's people on the left look back to the 70s and realize violence didn't work.
Brian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Brian Burrow, author of Days of Rage, America's Radical Underground, the FBI, and the Forgotten Age of Revolutionary Violence.
I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A lot of action at the state legislature yesterday. We're going to focus in on one issue they covered, school accountability. When the state assembly introduced a bill in January outlining how the state would hold publicly funded schools accountable for academic performance, reaction was strong. The bill included some controversial measures, including a process for turning chronically underperforming schools into charter schools.
The Senate's bill never included that option, and a new amendment introduced in the Senate Tuesday removed several other measures. Here to make sense of what's next for school accountability in Wisconsin is Aaron Richards, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel education reporter. Aaron, welcome back.
Hi, thanks.
Well, back in January, there were some pretty controversial proposals on the table for school accountability, including changing failing public schools into charter schools. Where are we today with all this?
Well, we're at a much different place, although I would say that from the very beginning in January, that both the Senate Republicans and Assembly Republicans had pretty different ideas on how they would deal with poor performing public schools. So any accountability bill is looking at how to basically judge the quality of your public schools. The second half of that is, what do you do once you determine that a certain number of schools are doing really poorly over time? What should we do with those schools? And that's really the crux of where we're at right now. The Senate has introduced an amendment that is a pretty toned-down version of an accountability bill that would essentially it would not turn failing schools into charter schools. It would allow the superintendent some ability to intervene in the schools, and the superintendent has some of that ability right now. And it pretty much keeps things the way they are. And that's not what the Assembly wants. The Assembly would really want to see sanctions for poorly performing schools. They've made that their position from the start. They say to have any kind of accountability bill with teeth, you have to have something happen to poor performing schools. Without that, in the Senate version, it's likely that there won't be a compromise this session and we'll just kind of continue the way we are now, which is that all schools will get a report card every year about how they're doing. If they're public, eventually the voucher schools will be wrapped into that same report card system. But at the moment, there wouldn't be any hammer that would come down on poor performing schools and sort of, from the state level anyway, make them change in significant ways.
Well, did any of the Assembly proposals from January make it through the Senate version?
There's probably the biggest nod to the Assembly version that the Senate put in was sort of this notification process that essentially would have public school districts notify parents in some way, usually it looks like by posting on a website, all of their options of schools to attend, even if they're not district schools. So basically forcing the public school districts to notify in some way of parents of all their options that they could potentially go to besides the district. Failing schools or schools that get low or, you know, kind of the lowest category of score on the report card would also have to send a letter to parents that basically notifies them that their child is attending a school in the lowest category. So that's kind of the biggest nod to what the assembly would like. And I think, you know, the assembly leaders are saying that that's just not enough.
Why have the Senate and the assembly had a tough time agreeing on school accountability measures? Where are the lines in the sand that have been tough to cross?
Sanctions are probably the biggest stumbling block. And it's an interesting issue because the Republicans control both houses, yet they have not been able to agree on the idea of whether there should be sanctions for failing schools, and if there are sanctions, what those sanctions should be. In part, that's because some of the more moderate Republicans in the Senate believe that just switching the management of a failing school, we know a lot of those are in large urban areas, especially in Milwaukee, that just changing the management of those schools won't necessarily lead to reform. But then you have the assembly saying, listen, a lot of these schools have performed poorly over time. We need to make a change. They want to make a statement. They want to show that, you know, they're sort of being aggressive on chronically underperforming schools. And so that's where you just can't see agreement between both these houses, even though they're all in the same party. There's the sanctions appear to be the biggest stumbling block.
We're talking about school accountability here in Wisconsin right now with Erin Richards. She is the education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And let's talk a little bit more about what is in this this Senate version right now. Now, one thing is that it accounts for the allowance that the state superintendent could intervene in poorly performing public schools. Tell us about that measure.
So the superintendent could, in conjunction with the school board and the school superintendent, talk about what kinds of changes could happen in that school that could potentially help improve the situation. Now, that's pretty broad. That could mean a number of things. I think it doesn't necessarily mean that the state superintendent is going to come swooping in and, you know, demand that the school board replace the principal. But it could mean that the state works more closely with that district or that school, or probably all of them as a team, and says, listen, what are some more supports we can do here? What's the biggest thing holding you back? In many cases, poor-performing schools have high populations of kids in poverty, kids coming from rough backgrounds, high mobility. There's a lot of other issues contributing to the low performance other than just, you know, a simplistic view of teachers not working hard enough. That's not usually the case. So you could see the state superintendent work more closely with the district on, you know, various practices that could improve the conditions of the school.
And the Senate version also has schools rated into five performance categories. This is instead of giving them letter grades. How might that work?
Yeah, so that's another important point. The governor in his budget had requested that all schools be given a letter grade. We have these school report cards now, schools would be graded A, B, C, D, F. Critics say that's really polarizing. You don't really want to give parents a report card that says their kid is attending a D school or an F school. People on the other side say, hey, listen, whether we call them significantly exceeds expectations or, on the other end, fails to meet expectations, there's still five categories. It pretty much means the same thing. But especially on the Senate side, there's some agreement that the categories, which again are on a scale of, you know, significantly exceeds expectations, or in the middle, meets expectations, that's just a more specific way of describing the school that doesn't distill everything down into sort of a polarized letter grade. According to Luther Olson, who's a longtime senator and a former school board member, he says, you know, besides the governor, nobody else really wants letter grades, even though that's been something that's been applied in other states. So you don't see that in the Senate version. I think that you would find plenty of support for that in the assembly, but that's not in the version that we're looking at now that the Senate is likely to pass.
And it sounds as though in the Senate version that if a school finds itself in one of these, the lowest performance category, then parents will have to be notified.
Right. So that would mean that every parent, and I think it's pretty clear, I had to check on this yesterday, but it would require, whether it's a public school or a public charter or a publicly funded private voucher school, that they would all have to send a letter or some kind of notification, maybe electronic, to parents that just says, hey, just so you know, you're attending a school that's in the lowest category. So that would be a change from what we have now. At the moment, school districts, you know, the data is publicly available, and most districts post their report card on their site, and many communicate with parents anyway, but this would put into state law that parents attending the schools in the lowest category would be officially notified of their school status.
Now, we know that the Assembly is not on board with, they haven't gotten what they wanted out of the Senate version. How closely does the Senate version align with what the governor may have wanted for school accountability?
You know, the governor signaled in his budget that he was more interested in parents having lots of information about their schools. So rather, instead of, you know, he was never really going publicly anyway down the we must have sanctions route. His position appeared to be, if we just give parents enough information about these schools, they'll make better choices, or they'll make choices that would serve to reduce the number of failing schools or lowest performing schools, and they would choose higher performing schools. I think you'd find quite a few critics that say simply educating parents may not be enough. That might not be a strong enough step. But that's kind of what the governor had wanted. So this is, I mean, I would say this is fairly close to what the governor wanted, although it certainly doesn't include the letter grades. But it does go down the path of saying, you know, here's more information about the school. This latest bill also tweaks the report card for schools now, which would require DPI to basically add in some more measures or adjust the metrics to better account for the fact that high poverty schools are going to have traditionally lower test scores. So how do we adjust the report card to reflect growth over time, growth with the same kinds of students that are in the school, to make sure that schools that are at least helping low-performing kids become higher-performing get credit for it? The worry among the Senate is if this doesn't get passed and the Assembly doesn't come up with a companion bill to match, that nothing is going to move forward on school accountability, and we'll have what we had at the end of last session, which is the voucher schools join the report card, but that's about it. That's the major change. There's no sanctions.
Erin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Erin Richards of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the latest on school accountability legislation in Wisconsin.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a look at the latest news on Governor Walker's presidential hopes.
First, Wisconsin's Budget Writing Committee held its first executive session yesterday. It marks the beginning of a process in which they officially hash out what goes and what stays in the governor's budget. The budget will still likely change once it goes to the full chamber, but this step is key in determining what the final draft will look like.
One of the first steps of the committee took yesterday was to remove 14 non-fiscal policy items from the budget. They also voted to end funding for the state's Citizens Utility Board. Here to tell us what the Joint Finance Committee did yesterday is Patrick Marley, state government reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
So yesterday, the Joint Finance Committee removed 14 non-fiscal policy items from the budget. And the biggest headline from yesterday is its decision on the DNR. What did they decide?
So the governor had proposed to make the DNR board advisory only. It wouldn't have any policymaking powers at all. And that got a strong reaction from both Democrats and Republicans, many of them questioning that move. And so this decision was made actually by the two leaders of the committee. They didn't need the full committee to act. But they said that was an item that they deemed pure policy, didn't have an effect on the state's finances, and so it should be dealt with as separate legislation. They pulled it out of the budget. That effectively kills it. So the DNR board would retain its current powers.
Now, it's worth pointing out that technically that is a non-fiscal policy item. Is it normal for a governor to put non-fiscal items in a budget?
It is a time-honored tradition to include policy in a budget from both Democrats and Republicans, and it is a time-honored tradition of people opposed to that policy to decry including policy in the state budget. Members of both parties say they try to minimize it, but the state budget is invariably ends up having a fair amount of policy in it.
What was the tone with Alberta Darling and John Nygren yesterday as they went about changing things and making decisions?
Well, so the two of them that are the co-chairs of the committee, and they just put out a memo that said these are the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, which is a nonpartisan group that helps legislators work on the budget, presented a list of about 50 items that they deemed were policy. The two co-chairs took 14 of those and just put out a memo saying these are the ones that are coming out. Then they had a day-long meeting where they voted on individual items. The 16 members on the committee are made up of 12 Republicans and 4 Democrats. And, you know, there are big disagreements between the parties, and so virtually every issue the Democrats raised concerns, dissenting opinions. You know, they really disagree with these policies, but you know, for the most part, the day was entirely polite, and everyone sort of listened to each other and had their votes.
As we said, there were 4 non-fiscal policy items. We talked about the DNR. What else stands out to you from yesterday?
Well, there were the other, I think, policy items that came out that were of note was one, the governor had proposed making some pretty significant changes to the way property is assessed to have it done at the county level rather than the municipal level, with the goal of having that be more uniform across the state. The John Nygren, the committee co-chair, said that he saw merit in doing something like that, but that was so complex that they really needed to deal with that as separate legislation. So I don't know the future of that issue. That could still have a life as standalone legislation, but that was a significant policy the governor had put forward that the committee members scaled back or the co-chair scaled back. And another one that got some attention was that the University of Wisconsin has been pushing in recent years to exempt their research from the open records law. And that has faced opposition from both Democrats and Republicans and was also taken out by the committee.
We're talking right now about the Joint Finance Committee's first meeting about the governor's proposed budget yesterday, talking with Patrick Marley of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And another item that attracted notice from yesterday was the decision to downsize Secretary of State Doug LaFollette's office. What happened there?
So Doug LaFollette's a Democrat who's been in office for 3 or 4 decades. And unlike other states where the Secretary of State has some significant powers like issuing driver's licenses, incorporate businesses here to some extent, or he has some business duties, but he really has very, very few duties. And they took more away from him by saying, well, essentially that cutting his staff from 5 to 2, I think he gets a temp worker as well, and then moving from him from an office space of about 4,000 square feet into the state capitol. And it's unclear exactly where he would be, but the space the governor had initially identified for him was 660 square feet that would be shared with the state treasurer. So, you know, a dramatic reduction in the amount of space he would have and the amount of staff he would have to do its work.
And what was Secretary LaFollette's reaction?
Well, he called it a train wreck and said it's going to result in some significant delays. One of the things that the Secretary of State does is gives he authenticates papers for like international business and international adoptions, and that will just slow down with fewer staff. And so he says that they don't know what they're in for, that people are going to be very upset about this.
Now, the committee approved cutting funding for the Citizens Utility Boards. How does that change approval of utility rates?
So the Citizens Utility Board is a group that often intervenes in ratepayer cases when utilities want to raise their rates. They come in and they make arguments that the rates shouldn't go up as much as the utilities want them to. And the state taxpayer or state ratepayers pay a portion of their fees. The committee said these folks should sort of pay their own way if they want to intervene in these cases, and reduce the amount that they would pay them. So, you know, we'll see how that plays out with how the Citizens Utility Board is going to react to that, how they're going to be able to find the funding that they would need to be able to intervene in these cases.
Now, broadband came up yesterday as well, including funding. What did the committee decide there?
So a couple of years ago, they started giving these $500,000 grants a year that would be available to private businesses that were going to expand broadband into unserved or underserved areas. And the governor wanted to increase that significantly to about $6.5 million, and then it would taper down to about $3 million after that. The committee viewed that as a little bit too much, and so they're going with grants of about $1.5 million a year. So it's a tripling of the current money, but also a significant reduction from what the governor had wanted.
And courts came up, court funding in particular. What did the committee find?
Yeah, so that's interesting as well. The governor wanted to, right now, like any state agency, the legislature and the governor allocate a certain amount of money for different court functions. With the committee going along with this, they're sort of backing away from that and giving broader sets of money to the courts and then leaving it to the state Supreme Court to figure out how much money to give to any particular program. They did go along with that, and so that'll give some new flexibility and powers to the court. One thing that there were a couple of things on the courts that they didn't go along with the governor on. He wanted to put the state judicial commission under the direct control of the Supreme Court. The judicial commission is responsible for investigating any kind of judicial misconduct, and then they file a complaint, sort of like a prosecutor, that goes straight to the Supreme Court for them to decide. And in recent years, we've had three justices be investigated by the judicial commission. There was some concern that you wouldn't want to put the Supreme Court in charge of the agency that investigates it, because they could defund it, they could take away staff. And even members of the court had said, you know, we think that it needs to retain its independence. That's what the committee did, so the Judicial Commission will continue to have the authority that it does today.
Now,
and then there's another... I'm sorry.
Sure, go ahead.
Oh, there's another panel called the Judicial Council that's... has a staff of one. It's a 21-person council, but they spend years going over things about procedural rules and what the best way to sort of conduct things in the courtroom would be. The governor had proposed abolishing that council. The legislators yesterday decided they would keep it.
Now, we had Mordecai Lee on earlier in the show today, former Wisconsin legislator, and he said that he thought there was a sense that the legislature right now is treating the governor almost as though he were the governor of a different party, one that they didn't have to listen to, in particular as regards the budget. Did you see any evidence of that yesterday?
Well, it's very early in the budget process. Yesterday was the first day that the committee began taking votes on the budget, and as with every cycle, they start off with some fairly easy things. You know, although the Democrats were in dissent, they weren't dealing with things like voucher schools or cuts to school or cuts to the University of Wisconsin. And so I think we'll have to see sort of how those big issues play out. You know, school accountability is another issue. We'll see where the legislators are. You know, today the Marquette poll came out, and it showed that an idea from the governor to issue bonds to help the Milwaukee Bucks build a new arena is very unpopular. Like 79% of people were opposed to the idea. It'll be interesting to see if that makes lawmakers take a second look at that to decide if they're going to go along with the governor or if they're just going to walk away from that.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Patrick Marley, state government reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about the Legislative Budget Writing Committee's first meeting yesterday.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.